Okay, let's unpack this. Imagine a real-life legal saga, right, unfolding down in Chile. It reads less like a dry court transcript and honestly more like a thriller. It's a story that kind of challenges everything you might think you know about crime, evidence, even the justice system itself. We're diving deep today into the really complex case of John Makarecha Coben. He's American-born, now an Italian-Chilean citizen, and his 2019 conviction in Viña del Mar sparked this huge legal battle just filled with controversy.
And what's truly captivating here, and why we're dedicating this deep dive to it, is just how many layers there are. Our listener, who we call the Learner, gave us this substantial stack of sources, everything from official court documents, expert ballistic reports, news articles, even video transcripts. So our mission today is really to cut through all that
You
information.
get to the core of it.
Exactly. We want to pull out the most important nuggets, highlight those aha moments, the things that make you stop and think, and basically give you a shortcut to being genuinely well-informed on this fascinating case without feeling totally swamped.
Good plan.
We'll be navigating, dense legal arguments, digging into the science, the evidence, and even touching on some pretty profound questions about, well, freedom of thought.
Okay, so at the heart of it, John Coben. He was convicted initially of frustrated simple homicide, attempted simple homicide, and unjustified firing of weapon.
Pretty serious charges.
Very serious. Essentially, trying to kill someone but failing, trying to injure another, and illegally firing his gun. This all came from a really chaotic incident during a protest in Reñaca. But as we track through the appeals, the expert analyses that came later, and his ongoing imprisonment, we find some really deep and frankly kind of astonishing discrepancies. They really demand a closer look. So let's set the scene for you. It's November 10th, 2019, Viña del Mar, Chile. The sources describe this huge public protest. It was widely publicized with these calls to action like Los Fleites Arneñaca, Fleites being sort of a derogatory term, or La Convocatoria del Melón con Vino. Specific instructions for attendees.
So organized, not just spontaneous.
Seems like it. And eyewitnesses paint this really vivid picture, a hostile, volatile environment. Valeria Silva Guzman, for instance, she recounted hearing shouts of fachos culiados, another nasty term aimed at fascists, and this chilling phrase, vamos a dejar la cagada. Basically, we're going to make a huge mess or worse.
Yeah, clearly a highly charged atmosphere.
Yeah.
Now, John Coben himself, he stated he was, quote, in fear for my life.
Right.
Said a mob surrounded and attacked his Mahindra pickup truck. He described a crowd shouting, Mátenlo, hijo de puta, kill him, son of a bitch. And one person, Sebastian Valdez Munoz, actually managed to open Coben's driver's side door. So you can imagine the fear.
Definitely.
Now, Coben, who's known as a pastor and also a libertarian activist, he claimed he fired his .4 S&W Sig Sauer pistol purely in self-defense. Initially into the ground, he said. His stated aim was just to disperse this aggressive crowd, not actually shoot anyone or cause legal harm.
And there's the detail about the vest.
Yes, exactly. It's noteworthy. Coben was seen wearing a yellow reflective vest, a chaleco amarillo. This was a symbol associated with these civil defense groups, the yellow vests, who were trying to protect properties during these widespread protests happening at the time.
Oh, okay.
And the prosecution explicitly brought this up, his prior involvement. Coben himself recalled being with about 350 chalecos amarillos just the Thursday before this whole incident happened.
So context is important there. Okay, the immediate outcome of this confrontation was, well, significant. Luis Ahumada Villegas got a gunshot wound to his left thigh, and Daniel Molina Meza's Hyundai vehicle was allegedly impacted by a bullet. Coben was arrested very quickly, and the charges that followed, as we said, were really severe. It set the stage for this long, complicated legal fight. Okay, let's talk about the initial legal fallout. This really sent shockwaves. On October 25, 2020, the Oral Criminal Court of Viña del Mar came down with a heavy sentence. Coben got 5 years and one day for frustrated, simple homicide against Luis Ahumada. The court basically believes he tried to kill Ahumada but didn't succeed. Then, 3 years and one day for attempted simple homicide against Daniel Molina related to the car incident. And another 3 years and one day for just firing the weapon without justification.
It then came the appeal, and this was a really critical turning point. The defense successfully used something called a nullity appeal, recurso de nullidad.
What does that mean exactly?
It's basically a way to challenge a judgment based on fundamental errors, either in the procedure or how the law was applied. It's a serious challenge.
Yeah.
And the Supreme Court's ruling, it was huge.
Okay.
The reclassified Ahumada's injury, it went from frustrated homicide way down to lesiones simplemente graves, simply severe injuries. That's a massive difference.
Literally.
Huge difference. And maybe even more crucially, the charges related to Daniel Molina's vehicle, they were effectively overturned completely.
Why?
Because of insufficient evidence for dolo homicidal intent. The Supreme Court stressed that for frustrated or attempted homicide, you need dolo directo, direct intent to kill.
You have to prove they meant to kill someone.
Exactly. And the court found this just wasn't adequately proven in either incident. Not for Ahumada, not for Molina.
So this raises a really important question, doesn't it? For us, and for you listening, How did those initial homicide convictions even happen if the direct intent wasn't clearly established?
Right. And that leads us straight into the forensic evidence, especially around Molina's vehicle. This is where the scientific details become, well, absolutely mind-boggling.
Okay, this is where it gets really interesting. Maybe even, like, unsettling. Mm-hmm. That initial verdict seemed solid, maybe. But when you start peeling back the layers, this totally different story emerges. One built on physics.
The unforgiving laws of physics, yeah.
Let's dig into the specific evidence challenging the claim that Copen's bullet ever even hit Daniel Molina's Hyundai Accent. The sources lay out multiple layers of scientific impossibility that are just staggering.
They really are. The discrepancies are profound. It creates an almost impossible scenario. First off, let's talk about temporal impossibility. Time.
Okay.
Video evidence clearly showed Molina's vehicle leaving the scene at 4.45 p.m.
4.45 p.m.
Got it. But the window when Copen allegedly fired his gun, that was between 4.5 p.m. and 5.05 p.m.
10 to 20 minutes later.
Exactly. The car simply wasn't there. It couldn't have been hit then.
Okay, that's pretty big.
It's huge. Mm. Then look at the hole characteristics in Molina's radiator. It was measured at 2.5 centimeters, and it was triangular.
Triangular.
Triangular. Now, Copen's .40 SNW bullet is 1.06 centimeters, and it's round.
Right. Bullets are round.
So you've got a 59% difference in size and a completely different shape. It's like trying to fit a, you know, round peg into a triangular hole that's almost twice as big. It makes no sense.
Doesn't add up at all. And then there's the ricochet angles. This sounds even wilder.
It is. So the prosecution's criminalistic expert, Juan Delgado Espinoza, claimed the bullet hit the pavement at a very shallow 2-degree downward angle.
Okay, almost parallel to the ground.
Almost. And then ricochet upwards at 15 degrees to hit Molina's radiator.
15 degrees up from 2 degrees down.
Yes. But ballistic experts like Christian R. Flores Morales, they point out a fundamental physics problem here. Snell's law of reflection, it dictates how things bounce.
Right.
It says the ricochet angle must always be less than the angle it hits at. Always.
Okay.
And empirical data from loads of tests shows the maximum ricochet angle a bullet makes off concrete is around 5 degrees.
Yeah.
5 degrees max, not 15.
Nowhere near 15. A 15-degree ricochet from a 2-degree impact. It's physically impossible. It violates basic physics.
Wow.
And there's more. Calculations based on these low ricochet angles, even the impossible 15 degrees is low. They show a bullet coming off the ground like that would reach a maximum height of only about 5 centimeters. 5 centimeters, like ankle height.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But the damage to Molina's radiator, it was measured at 35 centimeters off the ground.
35 centimeters versus 5 centimeters? That's a 7 times difference.
7 times. Think about that, learner. It's not just a small error margin. It's like saying a pebble skipped across a pond and somehow hit a drone flying way overhead. It completely ignores fundamental physics.
Given all these, like, physical impossibilities, I have to ask, did the type of bullet Copen used also factor into dismantling the prosecution's claims?
Oh, absolutely. And it added another huge contradiction. Copen used Corbon .40 SNW ammunition.
Okay.
And this ammo is certified by the manufacturer as lead-free.
Lead-free. Important detail.
Very. Yet the chemical analysis done on the samples from Molina's radiator, it detected lead and or barium.
Wait, lead from lead-free bullets?
Exactly. It's an absolute undeniable contradiction. The lead simply could not have come from Copen's specific ammunition.
So where could it have come from?
Well, the source even suggests it might have been something as simple as contamination, maybe from brake dust or something else entirely. The rodizonate test they used, while common, is known primarily as an orientative test. It can sometimes give false positives or pick up trace elements from other sources. It's not definitively conclusive on its own, especially with contradictory evidence.
Right.
So if you put it all together, the car not being there, the wrong size and shape hole, the physically impossible ricochet angles, the massive height discrepancy, and the contradictory chemical residue, it presents what the experts called an overwhelmingly impossible scenario.
Overwhelmingly impossible.
Yeah. For Coben's bullet to have hit Molina's car, the sheer volume of these scientific contradictions, it's not just about this one incident with the car. It really shines a light on a critical vulnerability in any legal system, doesn't it? How initial claims, maybe made in the heat of the moment, can just snowball and stick unless they're rigorously scientifically challenged.
Yeah, it really shows the fragility of truth if science isn't front and center from the start.
Exactly. A key insight here is just how crucial that independent scientific review really is.
Okay, but the questions didn't stop with Molina's vehicle. Luis Ahumada's injury, the one that started as frustrated homicide and got downgraded, that also presented its own set of perplexing challenges to the scientific narrative, right?
Indeed it did. The idea that Coben directly shot Ahumada also faced significant scrutiny based on the forensic evidence.
I think so.
Well, the initial forensic reports documented a 7-millimeter entry hole in Ahumada's pants and also in his thigh. But here's the really critical detail. No exit hole was documented, not in his pants, not in the initial report from the hospital Frick.
No exit hole recorded at first?
None recorded initially. This directly contradicts the prosecution's claim of a side-to-side transfixing injury one that goes all the way through.
So when did an exit wound appear?
An exit wound scar was only measured 87 days later. By a Dr. Tepper.
87 days later.
Yes. And that long delay, it fueled defense speculation. They suggested maybe it was a self-inflicted wound later on, or even a tungo, like a setup, faked somehow to implicate Coben more severely.
Okay, that's quite a claim. So similar to the Molina situation, the ricochet theory for Ahumada's injury was also under heavy scrutiny, but maybe in a different way.
Precisely. That same expert, Christian R. Flores Morales, his analysis explicitly concluded it's impossible for a bullet to ricochet to Ahumada's thigh from the ground.
Impossible again. Why?
Because bullets hitting hard surfaces like pavement at downward angles, even steep ones like 60 or 30 degrees, they tend to fragment catastrophically.
Bring apart.
Shatter, basically. And these fragments, if they even traveled upwards, would only reach maybe foot or ankle height. They just wouldn't have the energy or trajectory to hit someone in the thigh.
Okay, so a direct ricochet from the ground to the thigh is out, according to this expert. But what about other possibilities?
Well, the defense's own medical legist, Dr. Sebastian Ignacio Gonzalez-Martinez, he put forward an alternative hypothesis. He suggested that the projectile did change its trajectory.
Okay.
But by hitting some other external element before it impacted Ahumada.
Like what? A rock? Debris? Something else?
Could be anything in that chaotic environment. Hitting something else first could explain the weird ascending internal path of the bullet fragments inside Ahumada's leg and why there was fragmentation without any bone damage. This theory could align with a ricochet, but one that happened before hitting Ahumada, not directly up from the pavement to his thigh.
So the debate wasn't if there was a ricochet, necessarily, but where and how it happened relative to hitting Ahumada.
Yeah.
Still leaving a lot of questions about direct intent.
Exactly. Still very murky in terms of proving a direct intentional shot aimed at Ahumada's thigh.
So this whole journey through the case, then, it doesn't just uncover scientific debate. It really raises profound questions about the whole investigative and judicial process itself. It seems like these scientific impossibilities weren't the only flaws. There were big questions about how the evidence was even gathered and presented in the first place.
That's absolutely right. Several deeply concerning procedural and investigational flaws were highlighted in the sources. For example, the lead investigator for the ballistics part of this complex case, Captain Jorge Guzman Rojas.
Okay.
He was apparently from the SAV, that's a traffic unit, focused mainly on vehicle theft.
The traffic cop doing complex ballistics.
Essentially, yes. Not from a specialized homicide or ballistics unit. So right away, that raises serious questions about his specific expertise in this really critical, highly technical area.
You'd think you'd want a specialist.
You would. Furthermore, Guzman reportedly made subjective analyses of video and audio evidence.
Subjective.
Apparently without using qualified forensic experts or specialized software programs designed for that kind of analysis. Just sort of his own interpretation. This really compromises the scientific rigor and, you know, the objectivity needed for reliable evidence. And what's particularly striking here, according to the sources, is how the prosecutor, Fiscal Paula Rojasquero Fiscal, is the prosecutor in Chile. How she seemingly accepted this technically flawed information as solid evidence without perhaps enough critical scrutiny.
So the checks and balances maybe didn't work.
Well, formal complaints were filed arguing exactly that, that she should have identified these major discrepancies, that she might have potentially violated several articles of the Chilean Code of Criminal Procedure regarding objectivity and the duty to investigate all evidence, including potentially exculpatory evidence, using proper scientific standards.
Wow.
This apparent disregard, or at least lack of deep scrutiny of critical scientific evidence, it doesn't just raise serious concerns about the fairness and the reliability of the original trial in this case.
Right.
It also highlights a bigger issue, doesn't it? How systemic gaps, maybe in investigator training, resources, or even just oversight, can unfortunately lead to potentially profound miscarriages of justice.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so beyond these critical scientific and procedural questions, Cobbin's story takes this even more, I guess, unsettling turn, one that shifts the focus from the physical evidence, the bullets and ricochets, to the very essence of belief and freedom.
Mm-hmm.
This goes way beyond just the facts of the incident and gets into some really philosophical territory about justice itself.
It absolutely does. And this is where the implications really broaden out significantly. So fast forward to April 2023. The Court of Appeals denied Cobbin conditional release, parole, basically. And that decision was later affirmed by the Supreme Court. Then a subsequent pardon request in June 2023 also denied.
And the reasons why they were denied, that's the controversial part.
That's exactly it. The reasons cited are, according to the sources, particularly controversial and, frankly, deeply troubling to civil liberties advocates. The denials were partly based on Cobbin's, quote, beliefs, values, and attitudes.
His beliefs.
Yes. Beliefs explicitly stated to have been learned in the United States. A psychosocial report was central here. It stated he, quote, minimizes his the crime's gravity and the consequences to the victims, showed a tendency to aggressive passive aggressiveness, was predominantly dominant in his personal relationships, and critically rationalized his conduct based on his beliefs.
Rationalized based on beliefs.
That's what the report claimed. It even went so far as to suggest motivational interviews were needed to modify these beliefs.
Modify his beliefs. So his actual worldview, his personal philosophy, that was being judged as part of his like correctional assessment.
Yeah.
That really pushes the boundaries, doesn't it, of what we normally consider acceptable grounds for keeping someone locked up.
It truly does. And it caused a lot of alarm. He was also deemed, get this, a danger to society, partly for being loquaz, which means eloquent or talkative in expressing his ideas to others.
Talking too much about his ideas makes him dangerous.
That was part of the reasoning cited. Now, Cobbin and his defense, they didn't mince words. They explicitly compared this reasoning to North Korean policy.
Strong comparison.
Very strong. They argued it evokes practices associated with the repression of ideological dissent and raises a fundamental concern about freedom of thought and expression.
Mm-hmm.
Essentially, they're saying he's being punished for his thoughts and his way of expressing them.
And how does Cobbin himself see it?
Well, he perceives his ongoing incarceration as a montage, a setup, basically, or outright political persecution. He views himself as a scapegoat of the left, caught in a judicial system that he believes is, quote, full of leftists. This perspective really highlights the profound ideological chasm he feels exists, and he believes it's directly contributed to him still being behind bars. It casts a huge shadow, in his view, over the impartiality of the whole system dealing with his case.
Okay. So after digging through all of this, what does it all mean for you, our listener, trying to navigate this world just brimming with information, sometimes conflicting information? This deep dive into the John Cobbin case, it really reveals just how complex truth can be, can't it? Especially when you have legal interpretations, hard scientific principles, and deeply held personal ideologies all colliding.
Absolutely. We've seen pretty clearly how expert testimony and rigorous scientific analysis, things like physics, chemistry, can fundamentally challenge narratives that seemed quite established.
Yeah, the initial conviction seemed solid to the first court.
Right. And look how that changed. Think about how the sheer weight of physics and chemical analysis just dismantled claims that seemed maybe settled early on. We've also touched on something incredibly important. the need for truly unbiased, scientifically sound investigations from the get-go. And the profound, frankly chilling implications when a justice system appears to start weighing an individual's beliefs, values, and attitudes, not just in assessing guilt, which is already problematic, but in deciding their actual freedom, their parole, their rehabilitation.
So for you, our learner, this isn't just one man's tangled legal story in Chile. It's really a powerful reminder, isn't it? To always question, to always seek out multiple perspectives, and maybe most importantly, to insist on evidence-based reasoning. Especially today in a world just overflowing with information, narratives, and spin.
Mm-hmm.
Imagine, just for a second, being on that first jury. You're presented with the initial claims, the initial expert testimony, maybe without the benefit of this later, deeper analysis. How easy would it be to accept that first narrative? This case really underscores the vigilance that's needed from everyone, investigators, lawyers, judges, and yes, informed citizens, to ensure justice is truly served.
Well said. And as we close out this deep dive, maybe here's something to think about. In a world where information and sometimes misinformation spreads like wildfire, often without enough scrutiny, how do we as individuals, as a society, make sure that due process isn't just some fancy legal term?
Right, but a lived reality.
Exactly, a lived reality. And how do we ensure that justice is genuinely blind? Blind even to perceived beliefs and attitudes, especially those that might be unpopular or challenge the prevailing norms. What checks, what balances, what systems need to be robustly in place to prevent the very idea of thought control, however subtle, from ever tipping the scales of justice?